Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Flooding is the most frequent and costly natural hazard in Kentucky. On average, the annual losses top $40 million. Water runoff from heavy rainfall is greatest in areas with steep slopes and little vegetation. Eastern Kentucky, once home to one of the world's great forests, may have once exported as much hardwood lumber as any place on earth. After the trees were gone, industry turned to coal. Now that market has collapsed. So how can people who've been left behind make a decent living? Ecotourism gets a lot of attention and discussion, but are we ready for company? This week, that question brings us to the doorstep of Chris Barton. Chris is a professor of forest hydrology and watershed management in UK's Department of Forestry and Natural Resources and former director of the UK Appalachian Center. He's also president of Green Forest Work, whose operations director, Michael French, spoke with us in late April about reforesting abandoned mine sites. Chris Barton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Is there a direct connection between deforestation and the flash flooding that we've seen so often hitting communities in eastern Kentucky?
Absolutely. We know that the steep sloping areas of eastern Kentucky are prone to flooding regardless, but when you get rid of the forest there, that actually enhances the flooding potential in those areas. And the deforestation really does two things, and it depends on what type of deforestation too, but one thing that happens when we deforest a site, if we're logging or if we're mining, is that we tend to compact the land in places where we're using heavy equipment and things like that. So that compaction can lead to increased surface runoff, and that surface runoff goes directly into our streams and can elevate the flooding potential. So in our forestry operations, in sort of the general logging area, you're not going to have a lot of compaction. But when we do forest those steep slopes in eastern Kentucky, we have to put in a fairly extensive road network. And those roads can just be a pathway for water to flow down. So we spend a lot of emphasis and a lot of time in our extension efforts to train people to incorporate techniques to slow that water down and move it off of the road so that we can actually diminish the flooding potential. On surface mines, it's the same thing, but it's a much larger footprint. I mean, the whole mine gets compacted in the reconstruction of that landscape, and the limited infiltration on that whole watershed then ultimately leads to increased flooding. So the compaction is an issue. The second issue is we're getting rid of the trees, and those trees are so important for utilizing the water and slowing that water down and keeping it from running off of the surface. And we just published a paper from 50 years worth of data at UK's Robinson Forest, where we have actually been measuring the rainfall coming into that forest and the stream flow going out of that forest. And what we found is, on an annual basis, about 60% of the rainfall that comes into the forest doesn't leave via the stream. It leaves via evapotranspiration, or evaporation and utilization of the water by the forest, by the trees. So when we get rid of those trees, suddenly that pump of water that's going out into the atmosphere from the trees and the evaporation that's happening within that canopy is lost. So you have much more water going into our stream systems and, you know, increasing the potential for flooding in those areas.
Chris, I know that your work helped lead to the establishment of the Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative and planting more than 100 million trees on active coal mine sites in Appalachia. What are some important outcomes of that work?
Well, there are many. So one of the big things with ARRI was that we really opened a lot of people's eyes that you could put trees back on these mined landscapes. many efforts to reforest these lands failed, and it became sort of the conventional practice to turn these sites into grasslands instead of the forests that were there prior to the mining. So we basically showed techniques that would allow these sites to be successfully reforested. So the planting of 100 million trees meant tens of thousands of acres that would have been in non-forest state were actually reclaimed as forest. So one of the big issues with deforestation is forest fragmentation and the creation of these big gaps in a contiguous forest. So if you looked at a map of eastern Kentucky, say in 1950, it would be almost continuous forest. And now if you look at Google Earth or something like that, you see all of these little islands of non-forest. So that becomes a real issue with species migration and wildlife habitat, and reconnecting those forests actually helps with the conservation of a lot of wildlife species that are dependent upon those, you know, thick, dense, continuous forest.
Well, tell us about your work at Starfire Mine. That's near Hazard in Perry County, and how that's made a difference in slowing runoff.
Yeah, so Starfire Mine was an experimental area that in the late 1990s, Dr. Don Graves, who was at the University of Kentucky, and some other folks set up this experiment to look at techniques for loosening the compaction of these mine lands and how that would affect the growth of trees on these lands. So they went in and looked at a couple of different techniques, one of them ripping up the soil or essentially plowing it. And another technique was having the mining company just simply, you know, do what they felt like they needed to do to be compliant with the law. And then the last bit of spoil placement or rock placement, just put in nice, closely abutted piles about 6 to 8 feet in height, and then take the tops of those piles off with one pass of a bulldozer and to minimize any type of compaction. And I often refer to it as like a raised bed in your garden. And then they planted all of these trees on these 2.5 acre plots. And so 20 years later, that compaction reduction experiment really worked. And we have 80% survival of these are all native, you know, forest trees like oaks and yellow poplar, black walnut. And the trees now are 50 feet tall and you have closed canopy and they're functioning like a natural forest would function. So one of the things that we were interested in just recently is when we put these forests back on these mine lands, are they behaving like a forest that was, you know, on a regular non-mined land? So we set up an experiment looking at this water issue. Are these forests, as they're developing, putting organic matter in the soil and the roots are breaking up the compaction and essentially allowing pathways for water to infiltrate into the soil instead of running off? And sure enough, we did a study with the U.S. Geological Survey and with some help from the Natural Resource Conservation Survey and dug soil pits and looked at these infiltration rates and things like that. And what we found was that the infiltration on these sites were actually recovering to levels that were more similar to an unmined forest. Another thing that we did, which seems, you know, kind of silly, but no one had ever done this because we didn't have a lot of examples of mature forest on these mine lands. We looked at something called canopy interception. And canopy interception is just the amount of water that hits the leaves and the canopy of the tree and then evaporates off that and never gets down into the ground. And we know from our work at Robinson Forest that that number on an annual basis is, it can be about 20% of the annual rainfall that comes in never gets to the ground because it leaves via this canopy interception process. So we simply just measured that at Starfire, and lo and behold, we found that's exactly the numbers we were getting. In hardwood sort of forest, we were getting around 20% of the annual precipitation was evaporated right back off to the atmosphere. In conifer stands, it was actually a little bit higher. It was closer to 30%. So restoring that function the hydrologic function is really a basic part of restoring the forest. So it's tied together. And it was really neat, even though it seemed pretty obvious that that was what was going to happen. It was one of the first times that that's actually been demonstrated.
Well, that also goes to preventing that runoff, too.
Absolutely.
What about forest farming, silvopasturing it's called, or agroforestry? Can that be a realistic option, do you think, for economic renewal in eastern Kentucky?
Yeah, I think it can. I mean, certainly the post-mining landscape allows for that. You have some large, expansive grasslands and some forest in there that really need to be managed. If you don't manage them, they're going to turn into havens of invasive species colonization. So we think that this idea of silvopasturing, you know, where you do intentional rotational grazing of animals, cattle, sheep, goats, could be a possibility on these sites. And one of the important things about thinking about silvopasturing on these sites is that after the reclamation is done, you know, the soils are very poor. And one of the things that silvopasturing has shown is that that can improve the soil health in these systems. So it can add nutrients. You can increase the soil microbial diversity by doing these type of pasturing techniques. And also, you know, in some cases, as I mentioned, we have a real problem with exotic invasive species on these sites, such as autumn olive, multiflora rose. And it's been found that goats will actually eat these things. And so it might be a good way of sort of better managing the land, but it could also provide economic opportunities. These sites, I think, will be very good for forestry operations. And the forest industry in Kentucky is a $9 billion a year industry. And so we have about 350,000 acres of these mine lands in eastern Kentucky. So why not put them back in forest, for one thing? But are there other agricultural opportunities for these sites? And I don't think we're going to put them back into row crops like corn or wheat or soybean or anything like that. But grazing, you know, and combined with forestry actually makes a lot of sense on these sites. And it's something that we need to look into further.
Well, bringing this back around to what I mentioned in the introduction to the prospects for ecotourism, and we're going to be talking with EKU geologist Alice Jones about what's been revealed in her work surveying water quality in creeks, streams, and rivers. And I'm wondering, from your perspective as a hydrologist, are you concerned about what's in the water?
I'm always concerned about what's in the water. I get this question a lot, and about eastern Kentucky and the fact that I'm in Lexington. Well, the source of our drinking water in Lexington is in the headwaters that are in eastern Kentucky and are affected by all of these things. And so I'm concerned about, you know, the chemistry of the water. And we know that we have a lot of issues with some of the mining runoff with elevated salt levels. And we've done several studies in eastern Kentucky showing the impacts of elevated conductivity or salts in the water and how that's affecting amphibian communities, particularly salamanders. It's really hard on them. And we also are concerned about, you know, sewage in these streams. A lot of these streams have elevated levels of coliform bacteria that would be a human health issue if you swam or drank in them. When I was a kid, I grew up in central Kentucky, and I remember we would spend weekends at Boonesboro Beach and, you know, swim in the Kentucky River, and we fished in the Kentucky River, and we ate fish from the Kentucky River. And it saddens me that my kids aren't going to have that opportunity. We're advised not to swim in the Kentucky River and not to eat the fish that are coming from the Kentucky River. So I think about that a lot. And recently we had, you know, a relatively large flood event in eastern Kentucky. And I was teaching a class at Robinson Forest. And it's sad to see that not only the things that we can't see in the water, but there's so much solid waste and pollution in our streams. And with that flood, I was driving in Breathitt County along Troublesome Creek, and there was so much trash in the trees and along the banks. And it's just you know, if you really are starting to think about bringing people to Kentucky for ecotourism and anything around water, you know, fishing, kayaking, canoeing, you want to make sure that it's a pleasant and enjoyable experience. So we really do need to focus on both cleaning up our water from the perspective of the water chemistry, but also the physical waste, the solid waste, and the aesthetics of these streams as well. So I think we have a little bit of work to do. Not to say that every stream is like that, but we do have a lot of streams that could, you know, use some work.
Well, I think that answers the question, are we ready for company? And I would say we've got some work to do.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, but I think we have the opportunity to make it happen. You know, it's such a beautiful area, and we have wonderful natural resources. We do have examples of beautiful, diverse forests, and we do have great examples of wonderful headwater stream systems, but there's some work to be done.
Chris Martin, Professor of Forest Hydrology and Watershed Management at UK and President of Green Forest Work. Thank you, Dr. Martin.
Thank you.
We just heard UK forestry professor Chris Martin talking about the quality of the water in our creeks, streams, and rivers today. Now let's go to somebody who's been out there sampling and analyzing those waters. Dr. Alice Jones, professor of geosciences here at Eastern Kentucky University and chair of Kentucky River Watershed Watch, a network of more than 200 active volunteers who get out there and work to improve waterways through citizen water quality monitoring and community outreach and education. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And growing up in Eastern Kentucky, we thought nothing about spending a lot of time playing in our creeks and our streams. But that was decades ago. What do you hear from your students today? Have they had this kind of experience?
Well, what I hear more often is one of two stories. One story is my grandparents or my parents told me about playing in the creeks, but I don't because I just don't trust it. I don't believe it's safe. And then I'll sometimes hear from students that will say, yeah, our family has this one fishing spot that we go to or this one place that we go where we get in the river, but we don't go in the river behind our own house. They'll also report to me that they'll say, yeah, well, sometimes I do, you know, I'll go catch minnows or we'll go play in the creek, but I make sure that I have my tetanus shot. I make sure that we're watching for anything unusual, because I think the general feeling is that there is widespread general distrust in the water quality in Eastern Kentucky.
Well, you and other researchers have been sampling the waters of Eastern and Central Kentucky for many years and have provided reports of your findings. So let's first look at your work back in 2006 through 2009, when you sampled, I think, 1,600 sites around Eastern Kentucky, is that correct? And what did you find?
That's right. We call that study the Big Dip because it involved dipping water samples all over Eastern Kentucky. And that was primarily in the areas around Letcher, Pike, Perry, Knott, and Breathitt counties, kind of in that area in far Eastern Kentucky. And we found a number of things. First of all of those samples were taken by what are kind of off-the-shelf instruments or things that are readily available. So these were not, did not require a lot of expensive equipment. They didn't require a lot of specific like laboratory training. But the idea was if we could come up with tests that are easy and readily available as well as inexpensive, then you can do more of them. And the three that popped out from the better part of 3 years of sampling in that area were three different results. One was iron. Generally, iron above one part per million is considered toxic to aquatic life. And we had about almost 40% of our readings were between 1 and 5 parts per million. So that is considered quite toxic, quite a toxic range. And then we had another 8% that were greater than 5 parts per million. So that was certainly an indicator primarily associated with acid mine drainage immediately downstream of older mines, usually deep mines, pit mines, as opposed to surface mines. Directly related to iron, or kind of in context with iron, was pH. Now, pH, most of us, for even our middle school and high school chemistry, remember that 7 is neutral. But in Kentucky, because of our underlying geology, typically our streams will range somewhere between about 6 and 8. So, you know, a little bit acid, a little bit basic, depending on what the underlying geology is, but kind of in that range. Here, too, we had about 35% that had a pH greater than 8.2. Now, that doesn't sound like it's much higher than an 8, but you got to remember that pH is a logarithmic scale, not just a straight scale. So 8.2 is actually substantially higher than that normal range of 8. We also had a relatively small number, about 3% of our samples, that were below 5.5, which we would associate with acid mine drainage. So what's kind of interesting about those two numbers is, based on the iron readings that we got, we would have expected more lower pHs in those acidic ranges and fewer in that very high alkaline range. But what we think was happening is that alkaline is actually a result of some of the mitigation that has gone on, that in those places where there are hot spots of acid mine drainage, there have been efforts to bring in things like limestone gabions or limestone pools that actually neutralize or deacidify that water as the water flows through those areas. So those were two of our main analytes that were somewhat high. And then last but not least is conductivity. Now, conductivity is a measure of literally how much electricity can pass through water. And what affects that, what increases conductivity, is typically salts and minerals. So we would expect that in places that we have high heavy metals, that we would have high conductivity. But there are also things like household detergents and other household products that might be associated with septic systems or straight pipes that would also then lead to high conductivity. For the Appalachian region, a normal range of conductivity would be somewhere between about 200 to 250 microsiemens. And by the way, that varies depending on what environment you're in, depending on if you're in a very saline environment in, say, a tidal estuary in Louisiana, or you're at the top of a glacier in the Andes. But for our area, normal, let's just call it 250 is normal. What was concerning is that of those 1,600 samples that we took, about 22% of them were in this normal range. About another 23%, so if you add those together, it's close to half, was between 3 and 500. And 500 is kind of a yellow flag, if you will. But then what was really concerning is that the remainder, so more than half, a little bit more than half, were greater than 500. And 500 is considered a conductivity at which you would expect the majority of aquatic species to die. It's called extirpation. That's a scientific term for it. But about half of all of the sites that we tested were above that 500 limit. So broadly across eastern Kentucky, we found good water and we found bad water. And the number of sites with bad water outnumbered the good.
What can you tell us about the heavy metals and toxic substances that leach from coal mines into waterways? Kentucky River, which is tap water source for the urban areas of central Kentucky, originates in the coal fields region of eastern Kentucky. Should we in these urban areas be concerned about what's in our water?
Well, Certainly, but perhaps not by the way that you think you should be. Metals, first of all, they tend to be heavy or heavier. And so rather than staying in the water column, they will tend to drop out into the sediments. So yes, when we sample, and for example, when Kentucky River Watershed Watch in their 2018 and 2019 volunteer monitoring samples, the places with the highest heavy metal counts are in eastern Kentucky. But what may be a bit surprising to people that live a bit further downstream is that because those metals tend to settle out, and also because of the lock and dam system that basically has taken the Kentucky River and changed it from being a free-flowing river into a series of extenuated pools, a lot of those sediments actually drop out. So the things that will then reintroduce those heavy metals back into the water column is extensive flooding. So you have a lot of sediment that has fallen out and collected on the bottom, and then you have a real gully washer, and that then gives that stream enough hydraulic power to pick up those sediments again and roil them all up and carry them downstream. So it's really more in these extreme flood events, like we experienced this spring, that we're more likely to actually see those heavy metals moving their way from eastern Kentucky into our area.
You mentioned straight pipes earlier. We hear about straight pipes in eastern Kentucky. This is raw sewage flowing directly out of homes and businesses, perhaps, into nearby creeks and streams. Should this be of concern to downstream water consumers?
In general, I'm going to say no, because in the natural environment, when poop happens, there is something in the environment that will use that as a food source or a resource. You know, it's good stuff. We use it as fertilizer. And I think also that there has been a bit of a mischaracterization of assuming that all of the raw sewage, if you will, comes primarily from eastern Kentucky. Now, there are indeed a number of households that are grandfathered in, I believe, I may be wrong on the date here, but either 97 or 98, it became illegal to build a new house that had a straight pipe. But you have all the housing that was built prior to that that was grandfathered in and allowed to keep it. But what we forget about is that in central Kentucky, we are actually in a karst or cave environment. You know, think about all the little sinkholes and all of our limestone and our shale that's in, say, Lexington and the surrounding counties. And why the reason I bring that up is because if someone has a septic system out in their backyard and that septic system is basically on top of a bunch of cracked rock where the water is going to run very quickly down through that rock, it's almost acting like a slow straight pipe. So if anyone is in, say, Fayette or the surrounding counties, I would be more concerned or as concerned about household sewage getting into local water sources just as much from our local area because it hasn't had time to move downstream and have those natural processes of those critters and microbes that are in the water absorb and eat it like they should have. So I think that's a bit of a misconception. We need to kind of look in our own backyards for some of the sources of our water quality issues and not necessarily look specifically upstream at eastern Kentucky.
That's so interesting. We're not quite as sophisticated as we think we are here in these urban areas, are we? Well, and let me ask you, how do rural fecal coliform counts compare with urban measurements?
Well, so if we look at the state's 2016, what's called the Integrated Report to Congress, and this is the report that is required by the Clean Water Act that every 2 years, every state must report on its impaired waters and report on how many impaired waters they have and what they're planning to do to fix them. And if we look at a general map of where the places are that are not supporting their designated use, and that designated use could be drinking water, or it could be recreation, or it could be as aquatic habitat. Yes, we see a lot of red dots in eastern Kentucky, but we actually see very strong clusters around urban centers, particularly in the outlying rural areas where we have a lot of more distributed housing, kind of large lot zoning, those sorts of things, but also agriculture. Here where I live in Madison County, we're a cattle producing county. We're typically one of the top three cattle producing counties in the state, and Kentucky is the top cattle producing state east of the Mississippi. So we, in many places, our cows, and in horse country, our horses, they are also contributing to that fecal coliform load, as are the things coming out of the septic systems in those more rural areas.
Dr. Alice Jones is professor of geosciences here at Eastern Kentucky University. She also chairs Kentucky River Watershed Watch. Thank you, Dr. Jones.
You're so welcome.
Coming up after the break, a state senator's perspective on race relations in Lexington.
We still got work in front of us when it comes to police reform.
And hip-hop meets classical. Details as Divine Karama prepares to perform with the Lexington Philharmonic. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts. Through July 2nd, Rowan County Arts Center in Moorhead is presenting an exhibit featuring work by members of the Moorhead Art Guild. The free exhibition features more than 30 pieces by 13 Rowan County artists. For more information, including gallery hours, visit RowanCountyArtsCenter.com. And on June 6th at Josephine Sculpture Park in Frankfort, you can see a demonstration of Raku clay firing from 2 to 5 p.m. Watch as potters remove their pieces from the kiln at bright red heat and smoke them to create incredibly unique and beautiful surfaces. This event is free, but registration is required at josephinesculpturepark.org. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Race relations in Lexington, Kentucky in 2021 from the perspective of a state senator. It's Gerald Smith's focus in this latest in his Eastern Standard series on racial justice and equality.
It is my privilege to welcome Senator Reggie Thomas, a graduate from Bryan Station High School and also a graduate of Dartmouth College, where he received his bachelor's degree and later a Juris Doctorate from Harvard University. He was briefly an attorney for the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C., before joining the faculty at the University of Kentucky Law School. He later served as general counsel at Kentucky State University and is a practicing attorney. In 2013, Reginald Thomas was elected as a state senator in Kentucky, only the second African-American state senator to be elected in the state. And so, Senator Thomas, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, Gerald, it's good to be here. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I want to begin to get an opportunity for you to describe race relations in Lexington and Kentucky in 2021.
you don't give me any softball questions to start off with. Gerald, look, they're definitely a lot better than they were in the 60s, I was living here in Lexington. Lexington has come a long way in the last 50 years. I currently would describe the race relations in Lexington as good. I think probably better than most places. You have had African Americans assume some significant positions of leadership in Lexington. I mean, we've had an African American school superintendent here. We've had a publisher of our local newspaper who's African American. We've had two African Americans who headed the Chamber of Commerce as chairs of the Chamber of Commerce. And of course, we've had two African Americans who have been the executive director of the United Way. So we've had African Americans attain leadership positions here in Lexington, unlike any other city in this state. Having said that, I think you have to recognize, Joe, that there's definitely a wealth gap here in Lexington, and I need look no further than my district to see that. I've always said I have the most diverse Senate district in the state of Kentucky in terms of ethnicity, in terms of class, in terms of education. And I've got areas, neighborhoods in my district with a median income, Gerald, $197,000. That's the median income. And of course, the residents there are overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, white. And I've got districts or neighborhoods in my district, like neighborhoods, where the median income, Gerald, is $12,000. That's the median income. And of course, those areas tend to be predominantly African-American. So I think there's a wealth gap that we definitely need to try to reduce in Lexington. We don't have as vibrant a business community in terms of Black-owned businesses as I would like to see. I'd like to see more African Americans in leadership positions in the banking field in Lexington, where we have access to capital. That's one of our biggest problems, Gerald, that we don't have access to capital. But I would say overall it's good. There are some things that definitely need to be improved that I've articulated.
Yeah, I do want to bring that up. That last year you served on one of the subcommittees on the Education and Economic Opportunity Subcommittee for Mayor Gorton's Commission on Racial Justice and Equality, and there were a number of recommendations, as you know, that evolved out of that report. Are there any specific actions that you'd like to see the local government take, or just in general as various organizations seek to partner to address those recommendations? Anything particular that you'd like to see come out of those recommendations?
A couple, Gerald. One on the education front. I know our co-chair, Sharon Price, who, again, did a wonderful job as co-chair, one of the two co-chairs of the Education Economic Subcommittee, wanted to put forth the idea of money into the early childhood and the child as a whole, not just from an education standpoint, but in terms of health care, in terms of social skills. Really, that was Sharon's emphasis and really became our emphasis. And I think that recommendation ought to be taken seriously. I'm very pleased to say that one of the things I did to assist in that effort is that this year on the state level, we finally funded full-day kindergarten. So now full-day kindergarten will be paid for by the state in every school district. And I think that's a step to really drilling down deep and getting children in school and getting them to begin learning as early as possible. I've been a staunch advocate for early child education. That's pre-K learning. That's the next step, and that supports our idea of teaching children early in a very holistic fashion. From the economic standpoint, obviously, the mayor has approved funding for a study to look at ways in which we can help and assist small businesses, and I think we need to look at that because, obviously, one of our goals is to receive 15% contract spending, both from the city level, from the Fayette County Public School level, from the University of Kentucky level, toward money dealing with companies that are Black-owned. And we need that. That's, I think, one of the weaknesses of election is that we don't have a strong enough Black-owned business community.
You know, you've been very active on the local level, but definitely as a state senator, you recently co-sponsored legislation on no-knock warrants. So I'd like for you to tell the audience about that legislation, and what do you say to those persons who are not completely satisfied with that legislation?
Well, Joe, I've heard from plenty of people who are not satisfied with it. And I say, Joe, I agree with them. Senate Bill 4 probably doesn't go far enough as we all would like. I could have voted for a stronger Senate Bill 4. But Joe, I will say this. And now I'm talking about the legislative process. It's very cumbersome. It's very difficult. And it's not easy to pass laws. And Kentucky had to act on the no-knock warrants because Breonna Taylor occurred in our state, and it's a stain on Kentucky. And we had to say that, look, we want to take some effort to make sure that there's never another Breonna Taylor that occurs here in Kentucky. And when the governor signed that legislation, that's what I said to her family. I hope that we never have to say another name after saying Breonna Taylor. And so the bill does do some good things. It restricts no knock warrants. The only situations that are life-threatening where a violent act occurs or where you may see an act of terrorism or a hostage situation. It requires body cameras where a no-knock warrant is being executed unless the area doesn't have body cameras. And even then, it requires some kind of filming of the issuance of no-knock warrants. We restrict the times from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. so that no more police executing and breaking in doors at 12:30 at night like they did in the Brown and Taylor residence. And obviously risking gunfire, because obviously anyone's greatest expectation of privacy is late at night when the house is shut down. And requires also, Gerald, that the no-knock warrant be approved by the supervisory authority that's going to execute the no-knock warrant. So you've got to get an assistant chief's approval or a chief of police approval, which holds the police accountable when they issue no-knock warrants. So it does do some good things. Can it go farther? Yes. Would I have liked to see it go farther? Yes. But I am pleased to have co-sponsored that bill because, as I said on the Senate floor, now that we have this law in place, there should never be another Breonna Taylor in the state of Kentucky.
So what are your thoughts on the Chauvin verdict?
Well, obviously I'm pleased by the verdict. I'm certainly pleased. It was clear to everyone that what Derek Chauvin did was murder. I mean, you can't call it anything else. It was kind of, how can I put it? Just a realization, being Black in America, that we were all holding out of breath, because far too often, going back from Rodney King, and Eric Garner, and a whole host of situations, we've been disappointed in the outcomes of trials that have taken place. And so we were all waiting to exhale. We just all exhaled after we came back with that 3 guilty verdict against Derek Chauvin. Look, in this country, Gerald, I'm going to be honest with you. We're all pleased, but this is just a first step. We still have ways to go in terms of dealing with the police and how they impact the community. Now, look, we need police. No one that I'm close to is advocating that we don't need police. We definitely need police. But the way they're trained, Gerald, the culture of police, this feeling by some police that when they encounter the Black community, it's us against them. There's that them attitude toward Blacks. That's got to change, Gerald. That's got to change. So we still got work in front of us when it comes to police reform. But again, I think that verdict will cause a sea change in America in terms of how police interact with the Black community and minority communities going forward.
All right. Thank you, Senator Thomas. It's been my privilege to speak with you today and to get your thoughts on not only no-knock warrants, but other issues affecting Lexington as well as the state of Kentucky. Thank you and have a good day.
Well, Gerald, thank you for having me.
For your planning, as we begin to dip a toe in social gatherings, Beat of the Heartland, a free collaborative performance with Lexington hip-hop artist and activist Divine Karama and Lexington Philharmonic musicians that explores the power of community through music. It's set for Saturday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Loudon House in Lexington and will showcase the music of Divine Karama performing with a string quintet from the Lexington Philharmonic, local vocalists, and spoken word artists. Joining us now is Kelly Corcoran, Interim Artistic Director at the Lexington Philharmonic. Under Maine's Art Shackett talks with Divine Karama in just a few moments. Welcome, Kelly.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Kelly, what inspired this collaboration with Divine Karama?
Divine and the Lexington Philharmonic have actually been in conversations about trying to do something together for quite some time. So I think that came from a few different places. There have been hip-hop artists around the country collaborating with orchestras in different places, and as we all see that, it's really fun and exciting and makes me think we should do that. And then of course, Divine is just such an impactful wonderful collaborative partner in the Lexington community that I think, you know, as the relationship has developed, everybody's just been really excited to try to make some music together.
Well, from the perspective of creative process, how has it worked to blend these genres?
We did hire an arranger that created the string quintet arrangements specifically for this concert. And so she worked with Divine and JK and, you know, just made the charts for the performance. And so our musicians have had an opportunity to look at that. And then, you know, we're all going to be getting together in the coming weeks to prepare the performance. Additionally, you know, Divine and Lexville, we had a coffee hour chat talking about music and activism. So, you know, we've been exploring kind of the values of the performance and the partners and in the format and all of that for quite some time. And then just, it's been really exciting to see the arrangements come in and see like the actual parts that the players are going to play too.
And how have Lexville's classically trained musicians taken to this concept?
I think they are super excited about it. You know, everybody was really excited to be a part of this program and, you know, a big fan of Divine and the music and his work. And so everybody's been really open and excited and eager to participate and collaborate.
Okay. For the event itself, are there any COVID restrictions, limits on capacity? Do we need to register?
Registration is encouraged. There is a place to register on the Lexville website. And of course, you know, at Castlewood Park, if people are at the park, they will also have the opportunity to hear the performance. But if you really want to be able to be part of that up-close audience, then we really want to encourage folks to register on our website to be a part of that experience as well. But we're excited to just be in the park and be bringing music to the community. And then in regards to COVID restrictions, we are encouraging people to wear masks, but we are obviously watching what is happening in terms of guidance, local guidance and community spread and all of that, and adapting as necessary. We want to make sure everybody is safe and, you know, that we have a safe environment to gather. So we are encouraging mask wearing and are adapting and responding to the moment.
Okay. And I do understand that you'll be recording this concert in full and it'll be released online.
That is my understanding, yeah.
Okay. Kelly Corcoran, Interim Artistic Director at Lexville. Thank you, Kelly. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for talking.
And now let's find out more about this unusual event. Here's Art Sheckett, co-publisher of our arts and culture partner, Undermain.art.
Welcome to Eastern Standard, Divine.
Hey, how's it going? Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Well, we just heard Kelly Corcoran of the Lexington Philharmonic speaking with Tom Martin about the upcoming Beat of the Heartland show at the Loudoun House. You've done a lot of gigs over the years, Divine. What particularly excites you about this upcoming performance?
I'm just excited about the intersection. I think having hip-hop and classical music kind of come together can be inspiring for kids who may be interested in one genre of music but may not have much experience or access to it. May have never even thought about the combination of the two genres of music. So I'm just excited about bringing those elements together for the younger generation, but then also bringing groups of people together who otherwise may not convene and intersect. So it's just another way to bring people together, and I'm really excited about it.
What's it been like rehearsing with classical musicians from the Lexville?
It's been fun. You know, it's funny how many elements of music don't change. And even though it's a different genre and even though it's live instrumentation, there's still a metronome. You know, it's still music. So there's still pockets in which I can kind of immerse myself in as an artist that I can find and find comfort in when creating. So even though it's been different, there's still a lot of similarities. And it's kind of been eye-opening just to see how at the end of the day, music is music, and it's created to move people. And so it's been a great experience so far.
You know, and some of our listeners might not be familiar with your music, and I'd like you to talk about that just a little bit. But first, we're going to listen for a few seconds here to a brief sound clip from one of your recordings.
Sure. Believe it.
I was down, I was broken, out of love was all dead. Took me a while to get the strength to crawl back. When you got it, you just got it. We call it timeless, it never leaves. It was always in me. I was down, I was broken, out of love was all dead.
So talk about your music. What do you try to convey with your music? Where does your inspiration come from? And it's really part of your community activism, isn't it?
It is. A lot of people don't know because it's so commercialized and popular now, but hip-hop was created to be a voice for the voiceless. It was very in touch with the community in its original, kind of in the origins of it. And so I've kind of maintained some of those founding elements in my approach to the music. So I'm inspired by my faith, family, and community. And you're right. You know, at this stage in my career, I'm not really trying to become a big music star, but music is now a tool I use to engage community, specifically young people, because of the genre's popularity, because the culture is something that people within the community of all backgrounds enjoy. So I always try to figure out, how can I use this popular art form to impact and bring people together?
What kind of messages are you trying to send with your music? I know that's really important, as you've said, and your faith is really important.
You know, I think first and foremost, obviously my faith, but then also it's unity. How do we bring people together? How do we build community? You know, it doesn't take one person or one entity to stop violence, to try to, you know, heal people from addiction, to try to just uplift community. It takes all of us. And so for me, what I try to convey in my music is that we are all better off together, working as one, working as a team. And I think that's one of the underlying themes through a lot of my music.
What can people expect when they come to the show on June 12th?
People can expect a high energy show. It's going to be unique. We're going to have the screen quintet. We're going to have the DJ. So expect the unexpected, but it's going to be high energy. It's going to be family friendly, so you can bring the kids out. And it's just something the entire family can enjoy. And I'm just super excited about it. I know that we have 350 people register within the first couple of days. So the community seems really excited about it as well.
Really appreciate you coming by and talking with us today, Divine, and look forward to seeing you soon.
You too. No problem. Thank you all.
And just in case you missed it, Beat of the Heartland happens June 12th, 7 p.m. at the Loudon House in Lexington. You can get more information online at lexville.org. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, and Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online, on air, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.